I teach Reformation history and theology at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary in Berkeley, California. I've been there, I finished 1 year there after teaching for 11 years previous to that at Luther Seminary in St. Paul. Although I'm originally from the East Coast and most of my education, my growing up was there, so I'm kind of, my dad wonders when I'll end up in Hawaii, because I kind of down there. Said, well, we will really want to visit you. So the topic I'm taking up this week, a theology of parenting, and I advisedly said a theology. I don't want to pretend that there is the theology that is an answer. But to bring some folks together, as a mother, I'm a mother of a four-year-old. And what I realized is that in when my child came into my life, at a point where my career was fairly established, I was 40 when she was born, that it turned everything upside down. And not the least of which, when I went back to work, I thought it wasn't like just picking up what I taught before and just, you know, now I just go on with that task, but that almost everything that I looked at and thought about theologically was quite different. And that one of the things that was astonishing to me in having a child and sort of observing things is how often in my interaction with the adults, both my students and colleagues, but particularly my students at school, that qualities of their own upbringing or the way they shaped into the world were very front and center. And I was surprised at how in some ways I hadn't really noticed them before. It also made odd behaviors at faculty meetings a lot more interesting to analyze. and so then I began to think about how might we really harness this really life-consuming task of the care of children, whether we ourselves are biological parents or adopted parents, or that in some way what there's some community, whether you just whether you're teaching confirmation, working in church, that we have responsibility for children, and particularly those that are part of our families, this becomes a primary responsibility, and it cannot eclipse all the others, but it calls for radical shifting of the balance. And so that what interested me is how we might look at that work, both to what our faith says about this as a primary task, but the other way around, what this experience helps us to see and understand about the witness of the faith, and frankly, at points to challenge it in some of the presentations of itself and the way it has affected people. And that because the tradition in the Western Church has been largely shaped, of course, by those who dedicated themselves exclusively to the life of the Spirit, that in a way, the voice of those who have this experience has been regarded as important for the life of the whole community, but not, I think, honored as a theological resource for the community's own witness and understanding. And that's a real deficit, that we could take that up, indeed. I remember one time going to a Lenten service with a dear friend of mine who we taught together. Her husband was the pastor of the congregation where we belonged, and she had a very lively little boy who somehow in the middle of his meditative service managed to get himself wedged behind the flagpole. And as her husband said, I've been trying to encourage the church council to remove that American flag, and I think I have finally gotten an argument that will sell it. So that while people were praying, all of a sudden there was this, wah! You know, and I remember my friend raising her head and looking at me and saying, all I wanted to do tonight was come and pray. She said, now you can understand why once I considered entering the contemplative life. And it was both sad and funny, and then we went and got him out. But I think also I remember this sort of painful sense that what she felt was that she had given that up. And that let me say, she's been one of the pathfinders for me in thinking about these matters, so it wasn't always that way. But that is a terrible price to think we have to pay. And so it made me more mindful of how might we look at that very work itself as certainly maybe not creating a contemplative life, but a spiritually rich one, that we do not feel that we go away empty, even though we will often fall into bed exhausted. So those are some of the things, and the topic I'm taking up today is mirroring, and I brought a number of little things that I looked at, and want to talk to you a little bit about what one of the things that some of the theorists of childhood development are pointing out is perhaps a more revolutionary change in our generation, in this century, frankly, than was available to any century before that, is what we know about childhood development, what we know about how critical those early months and years are, that frankly people just didn't know. That there have been some fascinating studies as an historian, I tell you, looking at when did a concept of childhood arise? Was there one? How did people think about persons of certain ages in the medieval period or in the Reformation time? And when did childhood become sort of an elaborated social construct? And what did it mean in the 19th century, you know? But what seems to be consistent is generally a sense, indeed, that they were that children are sort of a vague muddle of things that came into focus in time. And so that in many ways what happened early on, I mean, that if you hit them or whatever, they didn't remember, they didn't, you know, that they were really formed later. And now we know that, alas, the opposite is true. That I can remember when my daughter was born, and when we were seeing a nurse practitioner for some advice about breastfeeding, which is not going well, and the woman said, "Are you going to be home with your child?" And I said, "Well, I'm on sabbatical, so actually she was born in February, and I will not have to return to the classroom until next September, and even then, I will be with her a lot in this." And this woman said, "I'm very glad to hear that. I think one of the tragedies of our society is that so many people end up having to put their children into care at 6 weeks." I mean, she said, "And we know now that some basic parts of who they are formed by the time they're three. And so if you're denied access to them for whatever reason, somebody else has the input." And finding that, you know, sort of really chilling. I mean, that it would be that much. And that's not me to lay blame in it. This is say people, I mean, didn't know that. That so much happened so early on. And that indeed, if you've talked to people in the therapeutic professions and educational work, we can see that there are certain hazards that can befall children early on that it is not clear will be reparable later. And that this is really sort of horrifying. You know, that certain kinds of wounds or deprivations occur. I think one of the most stunning sort of examples of this is in the physiological realm. My best friend, some of you were last week heard this, my best friend from high school adopted a little girl from Latvia who was born exactly 7 days older than before my daughter, so it's really funny. We've ended up with peers, we said we've just been late bloomers all along together, and brought these children home. But Sarah, she knew she had an eye deficit. They weren't sure how serious it was, and she was born with strabismus, you know, these seriously crossed eyes. And what's interesting is my friend had always had thick glasses, and I never really knew what that was about until she told me that when Laurie was a little girl, she had lazy eye. And they first sort of noticed and did something about it when she was 8. And by that time, it was far too late. Yeah. She has a sound eye in terms of, you know, what's the physiology, but it does not see. Because for that to have been corrected, they would have had to intervene much earlier so that the circuitry in the brain would form to teach that eye to see. So she has two eyes and monocular vision. One of her great concerns was that with Sarah, for them to fix this, the operation before it would affect brain development had to occur by the time she was 8 months old. That's sort of the outer limit, they thought. And of course, something went hideously wrong with the adoption that was being carried through before hers. And in Europe, they take the summer off. so that in June, when they were supposed to get Sarah, they couldn't go. And that meant they wouldn't get her at the earliest until August. And this terror she had that basically they wouldn't be able to fix this because it wouldn't come in time. Well, and we're waiting, it seems to be, but it was right at that 8 months limit. Well, there seems to be a way that there are certain stages in our development where things have to happen. And if they don't, it can be very difficult, if not nigh on to impossible, to restore them or repair them. Those of you who may at some point in your life ever run up against a narcissistic personality, I have a friend who's a therapist who said to me, you know, you've probably dealt with a lot more of them than you know because they are disproportionately attracted to the ministry. And she said, and there are very clear reasons why they would be. You know, and she talked about, she said, we believe that the wound in some ways that comes in this of a person who in some sense has this absolutely inflated need for approval, for status, for feeling above, I mean, this would be your classic hair pastor, above people, but at the same time simply cannot enter into sort of real intimacy that would, and is never fed enough, is put in precisely a structured position of power over others that can allow them to take a great deal, to apparently give a great deal, but never really have to. And I said, ooh, well, what should we do? What should we do? You know, and she said, this is actually, we find, one of the trickiest ones ever to sort of fix or adjust for, because it appears to occur so early and that it can really get sort of entrenched and developed. And so I thought of that we're saying that we as human beings, in some sense, like all the parts can be there, like my friend's eyes, but one of them doesn't see. And so that kind of knowledge, I think, is both up the ante in what it means to be a parent, you know, at the point where you're the most fagged out because you never sleep at night and your finances are shot to hell and all that. It's probably the point where you really need to be on top of things. And not when you sort of straighten it out, you know, when they're about five. But that the other side of it is that we have to recognize if this was not known, really understood or appreciated in earlier generations, means in many ways that many people who care for children talk about the sins of the parents being visited on the children. I mean, they themselves are now being asked to give something that they didn't get. Right? And as you all know, think about it, there is nothing that will make you angrier or more frightened or sort of tense than when somebody harps at you for something that you haven't got to give them. You know what I mean? And that what's the reaction is to say, what's the matter with you? Right? Instead of, you know, what's the matter with me? That this is, and so when we talk about this today, I want to say when it was first introduced to me, I just sort of walked out thinking, well, my poor child doesn't have a prayer. I was going through a very ugly marital dissolution at the time. There had been some, you know, awful things in the home. I was depressed. I kept thinking those first couple of months, it was like living with a zombie. And what will that mean, you know? And what I want to say is I don't want you to come away thinking it's hopeless what we've already done. I think the point is to recognize the dynamics. This is not just about what we mirror to our children, but how we begin to see ourselves and recognize if this frightens me, there's a reason. And what might I learn about where I am in need or where I am and how, if naught else comes out of it, is to recognize that no one of us can be everything for a child. Right? That we simply shouldn't expect that. That they need a number of people who can mirror in some sense and meet some demands. First of all, I think one of the most interesting things to me in the parenting work I did was the idea of temperament. There are distinct kinds of temperaments in human beings, almost like they can identify body shapes, you know. And most, and specialists in the area say, you're born with one. You can recognize it as even as early as infancy. Mm-hmm. Children who go berserk when they're overstimulated, who don't like a lot of bright light, who don't like a lot of noise, who don't like to be touched a lot. I mean, there are, and you can just say, they come in the world that way. It is not good or bad. Some sense, here's where the mirroring comes in, with a little help to figure out what kind of person you're living with, and how, in a way, you can work, a family unit can work with that temperament, and how you can help them maximize the strengths of it, and recognize what the pitfalls might be. That's what I call sort of good seeing. But I just want you to know, right from the start, I mean, think of it, oh, I have a colicky baby, I have a difficult baby. I mean, oh, she seems to be such a good baby. That's one of the worst ones, I think. Good babies, you know, they don't make noise. They don't get in people's way. And you feel like, oh, well, I have a baby from hell. You know? Some days, what do you mean? What's a good baby? Sort of. And I remember sitting in a workshop. We were in this class where this one of our educators, and you could get this kind of material, and this parent that said, these are some of the dominant temperamental types we look at. And we sat in this room, we were all given a graph to sort of chart them out. And there was this delightful man in our group, very laid back, whose wife had just started a business. So he came and they had three kids. And he got done with it and he said, well, gosh, this explains a lot. He said, here I am all by myself on this side of the graph. Well, all the others are over there. He said, one's hankering in the middle. Right? And he said, this explains a lot. And it was a no-fault explanation. So I offer that to you as one, I mean, if, with your pediatrician, or just say, give me some of that material on temperaments. We got it as a handout in our early childhood and family education class. And what was fascinating was, you may turn out to be something you didn't know you were. I mean, that you wouldn't have thought of yourself in that way. Okay? So that's just a kind of a simple thing about mirroring. I've begun to realize as much, for example, as my daughter and I are, we look alike in some ways, although her eyes are blue. We have kind of similar energy levels. It could be quite deceptive. But there are places where we are very, very different. And I found them threatening until I thought, well, she's just her own person. She's just a different person. And I can probably figure some about how that works for her. And say it's okay for us to be different so that she doesn't keep looking to find that she has to be just like me or vice versa. Okay, so, but the issues then of what children need, certainly early in life, and this is one of the things that you look at when a child is born and bonds, and although often the language is used of mother, what they say, this becomes a generic term in some ways. It is frequently the biological mother. It sometimes is an adult not related to the child and can often be the father. It is the person they are with most exclusively that they begin this process both of separation, right, which is very frightening for them in some ways, and an urgent need. So that as a child begins to experience him or herself as a kind of, as a subject, as a center with their own feeling, whatever, that in a sense they are still going to look initially to this person kind of to, is this okay? Is this, you know, or what is this? Have you ever had your child, Lucy just sort of blew into something and look at me and say, Mommy, I'm scared of myself.
And then we'll join the crowd.
But the point is that my job as a mom is to say, let's describe, let's give it a name. And I remember being really helped by it. Therapy said, you know, one of the things you can say is, this gets easier, this gets better. You learn to know this and absorb it as part of you. Okay? So I think many of you have maybe encountered the work of Alice Miller. This can be profoundly disturbing work. In some ways, Alice Miller herself came to conclusion that she in her later years, she was a Freudian analyst and separated from that because, you know, at some point Freud first thought that some of the remembrances of children were connected with actual sexual abuse of them, and then he backed away from that, so that he thought it was a projection of their own sexuality externally, and that you dealt with this as a fantasy. And she is one of the schools come to the conclusion that we must take children's experience more at face value, that really something happened that was not good. But rather, this is, I would say, the extreme case of a child whose boundaries are violated in that way. She's moving into a realm of even what it is to be denied sort of boundaries and clarity about who you are and what you feel, and builds on a whole school of psychology that's looked at the development of that. So I have to start, this is her little catalog, as she puts it, of what a child needs. She said, a child has a primary need to be regarded and respected as the person he really is at any given time, and as the center, the central actor in his own activity. Secondly, when we speak here of the person he really is at any given time, we mean emotions, sensations, and their expression from the first day onward. In an atmosphere of respect and tolerance for his feelings, the child in the phase of separation will be able to give up that sort of merger with the mother, or whoever that mother may be, and accomplish the steps toward individuation and autonomy. If we are to furnish these prerequisites for a healthy narcissism, as she calls it, you know, I mean, remember, Narcissus looked in the pool and couldn't tear his eyes away. A healthy narcissism would be looking in the pool and saying, oh, that's me. I like what I see. It ain't perfect, but it works. You know, I mean, that what she's talking about is a clarity about who the child is. She says the parents themselves ought to have grown up in such an atmosphere. There's the rub. Parents who did not experience this climate as children are themselves narcissistically deprived. Throughout their lives, they are looking for what their own parents could not give them at the correct time. The presence of a person who is completely aware of them and takes them seriously, who admires and follows them. This search, of course, can never succeed fully, since it relates to a situation that belongs irrevocably to the past, namely to the time when the self was first being formed. Nevertheless, a person with this unsatisfied and unconscious need is compelled to attempt its gratification through substitute needs. The most appropriate objects for gratification are a parent's own children. Now, can you see how the pattern is going? Right. So that a newborn baby is completely dependent, and since the caring of the parents is essential for the baby's existence, he or she will do all they can to avoid losing them. From the very first day onward, a baby will muster all his resources to this end, like a small plant that turns toward the sun in order to survive. Now, it's a remark, what I want to say is you can just feel, can't you just say, oh Lord, you know, about what, the point is here, in many ways, it's the knowing and the naming. You cannot be a perfect parent, and you do not have to be a perfect parent to have a healthy child. But what she's claiming, and I think this is the interesting one, and this is the point, it seems to me, where this mirroring goes two ways, that all of us fail each other at points. And it's not lack of love or even lack of will. And sometimes it's both, and there's grace for that too. But if you can begin to recognize, and see what she says, it becomes unconscious, because frequently what happens is you push it down. You just, you know, and you adjust to what's expected of you. This is one of the things that they think is the terrible result, is that then what a child will do is live as she calls it, an as-if personality. Right? That is the one that meets the expectations and gets the goods. And what happens over time is they really don't come to know themselves or lose any sense of that. And I think we all know, what do you think midlife crisis is about? I mean, I think it's probably, of course, about some transitions in midlife, but I think it's about this sort of, this is the last sort of hurrah. I mean, it's from here to eternity. And I'm feeling empty. Something is missing here. What is hurting? And people say, oh, well, he's acting like a child. Right. Right. And there's some reason for that. That how it is that actually in the care of children, one begins to come into, and the other thing is that they're very threatening when they begin to do that. When they do the very thing that was fearful for us, I mean, and I think a lot of this does happen below the surface, but to begin to be mindful and to recognize that then in this very turmoil it presents, in a way you are being given a chance for growth. You cannot, and this is the sad thing, is, you know, the people who, and now we all know them. I even went through a phrase like this, you know, about, well, you know, in my family, you could never deduct, if only my parents, and you want to say, the point is, just as she's saying here, the point is for the child to individuate and move on. If your solution to this is to go back and hate them for what they didn't give you or didn't do right, you're no better off than you were before, right? And the recognition is, too, is that, we've often said, you know, it's not that they withheld something they had to give, right? That's not what it would be. And to begin to recognize that and see that, I think you can often find, you begin to move across some barriers to that generation behind you as well. Seeing this, Alice Miller is of the opinion, and if you read our other books, that the general parenting wisdom, and what I remember, this woman grew up in, I mean, she's Swiss or German. I mean, what she, her great comparison is what, how Germans raised their children in the 19th century and such, and she said, you can put together, it's not so hard to explain what happened in the 30s and 40s if you look at a long tradition of dampening that, and you combine people who finally come in touch with the most fearsome, frightening, ugly emotions and combine it with absolute obedience, and what do you think you get? Right. That, so she takes whole sections out of parenting manuals from the 19th century into the 20th, and it is really horrifying. It is really horrifying that what they thought was just okay. But it wasn't that, I mean, and this is her point, is this is a societal problem. This is, in some sense, a kind of a vision that is so that parents, if you're not careful, as she said, become, in a way, society's own agents for conscripting children into just perpetuating this. So that it's being, so that really the places where you're parenting is the hardest, where you're the most challenged or unnerved, having that days where you're just unnerved, is the time to say, this is the moment to look. It is, in some sense, a moment of kairos. And it's not something you should or should have to do alone in the looking at what this is about. So Alice Miller is particularly, when this happens, when in some sense the parents' own needs that get pushed on the child in terms of expectations, or have, and you know, I mean, it's all that thing. How many of you sort of were going nuts because your kid didn't get potty trained on time? That somehow or other that was a reflection on you. Or failures at other things, or this kind of, you know, that there is this point of being terribly invested in your own sense of security in what this child will be, and that she's saying they're smart, smart, smart from the beginning. And they will adjust to that. They're smarter about you than you can ever know. That's one of the reasons they know just what buttons to push. Because they have to be to survive. They're you just watch children. It is uncanny. Uncanny on many of them in picking these things up. Have you ever felt real? I mean, I remember one time being really going through, because very depressed. Lucy was in a bathtub. Yes, I'm washing the dishes. So a voice comes out, Mommy! And I said, yes. She said, are you being sad? I mean, you know, and weeping into the sink, and she goes, I said, well, a little bit. She said, well, stop it. Pretty clear, because, I can't deal with that. I have other needs. You have until I'm ready to get out of the tub. How does she even know? And one of the things you'll find is that when they sense you slipping away from them, they know the most certain way to get you back is to make you angry, is to make you upset. So don't take it personally, but they do. Now, the argument of Alice Miller and others is that when children are beginning this sort of adjusting, one of the things they learn very quickly is that it's not safe consciously to experience their feelings, the feelings of their own. And that usually this shows itself, of course, in the feelings none of us are really happy feeling. The dark, what Jung and others call the shadow side, being jealous, right? Envious, feeling hateful, feeling angry, anxious, lonely, or impotent. And that's the piece that you find. Now, think how often, how many of us come from family and say, well, anger was really a problem in our family. Because anger was so distinctly absent from mine, I think it's probably safe to say it was a problem. Right? That it wasn't, yeah. And that children, see, then what happens is as these things are repressed, they come back. They come back in some way. Because, and we all see that in ourselves. My best friend growing up was really funny. She said there was sort of a clear, unspoken rule in her family. If you were sad or angry, you went to your room, and you stayed there until you were otherwise. And then you came back. I remember times going over to her house, and everybody was in their room. You know? I mean, but it was really, she said, you did, it just knew that. Those things were not displayed. Right? And how that has come back, I mean, how that comes back, because feelings, I mean, I think it's right to say, we have to look at, a feeling is a feeling. It's just there. It's not, you don't judge it, but it is learning, what does it tell me, and how do I handle it? Well, if you're told, don't. I mean, they can't learn. And most of all, what do they pick up from us? I need to be frightened of this. This is unspeakable. This is unshowable. This is bad stuff. Now, forgive me for getting a little autobiographical, but it's always the privilege of being up front, but I think these things have to be concrete. I do have lovely parents who don't. I remember one time my mother saying, whatever you do, don't marry a man who won't fight with you. Because my father just won't get into it. I mean, he is about as mellow as they come. But, I mean, he has his times being angry. But it was very clear that I had two parents who handled it quite differently. And my brother and I was with no idea what was, how should you do this or whatever. Well, I married a man who knew how to get angry. But what I didn't recognize was it wasn't healthy because he could let it all hang. But I solved the problem. I learned what I hadn't learned before. I'm not sure that I've learned it well enough, and I know now that when my daughter loses it, calls me names, threatens me, and that's, I'm gonna smack you. I get like this, and I think, nobody's ever gonna talk to me like that again. And I go, wait a minute. She's four. Calm down. Because if you respond like that, she's not going to do any better with anger than I did. Do you see what I mean? And that's, it's not like, well, if my mom and dad had only learned how to do that better, I wouldn't have. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's not the point. But I felt something and didn't learn it well. And it didn't go away. Do you see what I mean? And I think that's the piece. So how can we, in the light of these awful onslaughts, I mean, sometimes that they are, sort of help them, it's not to say every feeling is all right, but help them learn what they are, make discernments, give names to them. This is very empowering. Have you ever had a child just come in and, what do we do about something? And then you say, describe what you hear them, what was the situation? You were going to daycare and your friend grabbed this from, something, your friend grabbed this from you and it made you really angry, so angry that you hit him. Is that right? You know, that kind of, and realize they don't know that stuff until we help, you know. And now it sounds like that doesn't feel right to you. You're still angry and upset. So where do you go from here? So I think that that piece early on, and I mean, believe me, I hate it. I hate it. I just come home some days and feel like saying, I really had a better day with a bunch of adult hypocrites, and I do not want to come home and just have a full frontal all night. I am tired, I am, you know. But the other side of it is that I am really struck sometimes with some of the things that erupt on at other times. And I think, now, what is that? What is she in a way mirroring to me? But so what else, in other words, is again, this fact that they don't let themselves feel these things and learn what they feel like and develop, let me say, appropriate fear at points, right? Appropriate respect for the strength and danger of these emotions. They kind of avoid the whole territory. And then they're at greater risk, actually, later on, because it may be repressed, or they may react to it, or we react to it. First, a great amount of intellectualization, which I think is often what you can find in the church, that theology can be very intellectual, and it holds those things at bay. Persons also who kind of develop the superior attitude, I'm above all that, right? Others who, what's it often, will begin this kind of process of projection. And I bet there's not a person in this room who hasn't at some point been on the receiving end of that. Right, where you've been, you've ever had somebody like, about something, and you sit there and you think, we simply don't know each other well enough for me truly to be the cause of this. There is more going on here than, but it's out, right? And it comes out in a way that can be very destructive and dangerous. So I think part of it is argument, how do we make room for feeling, but not only theirs, but ours? That the point of giving it names, of being able to describe what has happened, and think, what has this elicited in me? Right? And I don't mean just doing that for them, but making a space to do it for yourself in recognizing that it's very likely, you see, that you are going into this business with some serious handicaps, not of your own making. And that is okay. That is okay. But that this is a moment in ways to look at those things so that, frankly, your children don't end up terrorizing you. Right? I mean, sort of making the pain and anguish around this deeper. But recognizing in the process of helping them, you'll do it too. You see what I mean? You'll sort of negotiate those. And that's why I think it's very important to recognize they are our teachers in that way. They are smarter about us emotionally many times than we can be ourselves because they feel so dependent on us. They have studied, remember, children start smiling and laughing really quite early on when suddenly you know it's not just gas. It's really related to you. But scientists have said it's clear that this is an extraordinary adaptive mechanism in the evolution of children. Human babies are as powerless and helpless as they can get. And they know early on that they are totally dependent on the care of adults. And they watch that and think what they begin to do is coo and laugh and smile because it's irresistible. It bonds an adult to them. And we all know, we think something about a person who can just walk away from a baby. I mean, it does seem like there's kind of a deficit there. You know? I mean, in terms of, but when you think about that, of how early on that happens and what that means, and in some sense, it doesn't stopped for a long time. I think the reason adolescence is so hideous is because they know they've got to make the break. And at one level, they really want to make the break. And in another way, they're terrified that you won't be there. And you get, in some ways, exactly what you had in toddlerhood again. It's the next big passage into a sort of some autonomy, some self-definition, but the dependence is not over. It seems to me we can look at this ourselves. I mean, its theological implications for what it means in our relationship to God, I think, are just simply mind-boggling. Right? If works righteousness begins as early as smiling and cooing when you're only a couple of months because you're afraid if you aren't what you're supposed to be, you'll be abandoned. There are some deep levels at which a message of grace has to penetrate. But you know, you don't have to smile and coo for God. So here, though, as we think about our children and ourselves, is probably indeed this early sense of having to adjust ourselves to get what we need, and sometimes at the expense of really becoming or knowing ourselves. And I'll talk some more about that Friday. We'll talk about letting go, what it is at some point to say, you know, part of being a parent is loving a stranger in our midst. Right? And they aren't me, and I don't get it. I just don't get it sometimes. So this piece of coming to know yourself in it, in examining your own feelings. I did two rounds of what? Systematic training for effective parenting. It sounds like a Boy Scout badge. I don't know if you've ever. But I found a very interesting one, very helpful in thinking about our relationships to children and as a parent. And one of the things they give here is some helpful questions. When you get upset or that you say, why do I feel I have to be in control? Do I need to feel superior? Is my drive that I've got to do this absolutely right and be perfect? Or who am I worried that I won't please if my child isn't this, that, or the other thing? And I thought one of the most impressive ones that I have sort of challenged myself on a number of occasions are expectations. Why do I expect this of my child? I mean, that's sort of like, why is that? I'm not hung up here. What's in it for me if my child meets this expectation? Is this expectation based on something I want for myself or on what would be good for my child as I see it? And finally, is it realistic to expect my child to be able to do this? Now, the point, it seems to me, is that if you can come down to it and say, actually, this is based on something I want for me, then take care of you. That's all right. But I have really been struck the number of times when I thought about, well, I want Lucy to do this, to do this, that I sometimes put those questions to myself. What's at work here? And as we make decisions, our children could be doing so many things we never see them. As we make decisions about, well, what would really be good for them? What is it that I would like? What would be a balance of helpful things? And even acknowledging it. Piano lessons is going to be a big one. In my family, it's good to read music. Well, what if they don't want to take piano lessons? Well, what is it to say? I don't expect you to do this forever, but I think it is important for me that you be able to read music, because music's a part of what we do. Is that fair? Well, it's something to think about. But that's looking at it a little differently and just saying, it's good for you. Because your child will know tons of people can't play the piano who are surviving just fine. Right? So that's not going to be very convincing. Okay? I think, in conclusion, let me pick it. The one thing that I found, this is a quote from Alice Miller, where she talks about, she said, things we can see through do not make us sick. They may arouse our indignation, anger, sadness, or feelings of impotence. What makes us sick are those things we cannot see through. Society's constraints that we have absorbed through our mother's eyes. Eyes and an attitude from which no reading or learning can free us. Okay. I think what she's pointing there is that it really does take the kind of human engagement not just read me, you'll read about this and say, oh yes, that's me, but you won't necessarily fix it. But the human engagement that the process of parenting itself provides, but also the community of parenting, right? Of being with others, of and what a nice phrase that he uses is, we need enlightened witnesses. Not only persons in our society who will speak up for children and the often really abusive and negligent ways in which we go about dealing with them, but enlightened witnesses in our own circle of persons who can say, gosh, Alice, you really seem bent out of shape about that. And I'm not sure, what's going on? Can you remember, to help us think so that we don't have to sort it all out through those children? Okay. That I think is a very, I like to think of it as part of the Lutheran claim that one of the gifts of the church is the mutual consolation of brothers and sisters who can see where we cannot see, who can dare to give us a hand to bring us to freedom in a place that is too fraught with peril and fear for us from the past. Because what is at root is always the terror of abandonment and the loss of love. How many times do your children say, as you are cleaning up something or paying an enlarged insurance bill because they smacked the car into something, do you still love me? Or I am going to behave in such a way that if you could possibly abide it, it's clear and certain proof that you must still love me. Rather than verbalizing it. Because that is our deepest fear, is that love can be removed. And one of the most poignant moments when my daughter was pushing my buttons about being, you know, I don't like the way you do this, I want this, I want that, and she said to me, I wish my daddy would come back. And I thought, well, now this could be, I think this was a moment where I wanted to go, you know, it's kind of, my mother's way of dealing with stress. And instead, I caught myself and thought, well, this is more about what she wants from me than it is about a person she doesn't know, really. And I looked at her, I said, well, honey, I don't share that. I don't want the same thing you do. And she pressed a little, and at that point, instead of she felt like she was crying. And I held her, and she said, Mommy, what's the matter? Doesn't he love us anymore? And I thought, there it is. There it is. And that means I'm all the more dependent that you do, that you don't get away from me, not in sadness, not in busyness, not in friendship, not in anything, you know. And I just said to her, I said, this is going to be an unsatisfying answer. But the question you have just asked doesn't really apply to the situation. I said, your daddy was an angry man. And I said, and I can tell you this, it didn't have to do with you. And the truth is, it didn't really have very much to do with me. But I thought, how wrong, what's the matter? Doesn't he love us anymore? Don't you love us anymore? That's really what they press at. And there, it seems to me, is an important theological implication. They want to be loved for who they are. And that means we're going to have to put up with things we don't like. As one of my friends in St. Paul always said, Lucy would say, oh, I've been a bad girl. And I'd love to. She said, there's no such thing as a bad girl. There's just behavior that's not appropriate. And that became some of our theological mantra. Or my brother's, I like it may be disgusting, but it's age appropriate. Right? But what it is to say, yes, I can see that. We're going to have to find a way to deal with that. But it's not about my loving you. There's just nothing you're going to show me. And more importantly, there's nothing they're going to show you about yourself that makes you unworthy of love. There's not, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, we are as vulnerable as they are. If my child finds out I'm a nervous wreck about this, or that I'm really never handled this well, or that I can't do this, or I'm afraid of this, will they not love me? Right? It's negotiating that. The theological implications, it seems to me, is think of what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13. About in the end to be known as I am, I will know as I am already known. There is nothing that God does not see. God is not waiting to assess how you complete this course of parenting before you get your certificate. Indeed, when we think of Scripture telling us that perfect love casts out fear, it is this issue. What is the worst fear we have? What is the worst fear as believers? That we would be abandoned. Luther himself, you know, saying, I wonder if I'm among the elect. It really wrings my heart to think how much comfort that man has brought to many of us through his writings to see him asking that question. Am I going to be in the end abandoned? That I wasn't worth God's time. That what we learn here of how deep that fear is, how relentless the drive is to try to offset it by doing things right, or by denial, or by all the things that we look at as the root of how our alienation from God manifests itself. It seems to me parents and children in that relationship have a great deal to speak to the world about what this means. In the end, I think, too, this is an insight for us for how we will interpret and give the biblical witness. I'm going to end with one passage. This was from one of Alice Miller's patients, who was probably really caught in this thing of being a very good girl and ended up in a great deal of grief and anguish later. She says, even in the midst of all this, she retained her critical ability even in theological matters, and she was able to ask questions in a calmer frame of mind. And then she gives this sort of one of her talks with this woman, who said, it says in the Bible we should not make any graven images. Well, why not, actually? Why is God allowed to see all our weaknesses, to read our most secret thoughts without our being able to stop him, and to punish and persecute us for having them while only his weaknesses must remain invisible? Has he no weaknesses? If God is love, as I was taught, then he certainly should feel free to show himself. We would learn from his love. Does he hide himself, or is he hidden by those who made an image of him, using their fathers as a model and passed it on to us? For the Bible does offer a clearly defined image of God if we only dare to look closely enough. His image can be pieced together from his deeds. It is the image of an irritable, hypersensitive, didactic, authoritarian parent. The Bible speaks of God's omnipotence, but the divine deeds it describes contradict this attribute. For someone who possessed omnipotence would not need to demand obedience from his child, would not feel his security threatened by false gods, and would not persecute his people for having them. Perhaps the theologians are not in a position to create an ideal image of true goodness and omnipotence, differing from the character of their real fathers, until they have seen through this character. And so they create an image of God based on the model they are already familiar with. Their God is like their father, insecure, authoritarian, power-hungry, vengeful, egocentric. Perhaps they could imagine other similarly anthropomorphic images of God if they had had a different childhood. Now, I mean, you struck, I'm glad she wasn't in my office. I know. But what you struck here is the sense that this is not to undermine the normative, the power of Scripture we give, but we need to recognize it's just the way, as children, it's pointed out, that we overlook inconsistencies or conflicts in our parents often. You know, how do we hold that together? That in many ways, we have done that with this very witness in Scripture that sometimes is quite hard to hold together. And what is that in its own way as a sign of our own questing and moving to come to an understanding of who we are as God's children and what this divine parent is like, and how that can be an image for our own relationship as parents in our lives. And I think that that's a place where this really sort of presses us about, will God cease to love me if I'm not this, and this? Is it a terrible thing to be angry before God? What is it like to yell at your parents? Right? You know, to say, Nancy Winder told this wonderful story of a parishioner who at one point in her life wrote on the inside of the linen closet door, clearly where she knew her mother would see it regularly, statement, "I hate Mom." And after it had been there a while, her mother came and said, "I'm cleaning the linen closet today, and I wondered if you still needed that." That's great. And the person has said to her everlasting shame, but I think to a sign of extraordinary sort of vitality in this family, she looked at her and said, "Yes." Now, it seems to me those are not easy things to receive. I don't say that, but what is it? What difference would it make to think that you could bring those things? Say, God, I think of Luther at one point, say, "I came to the point where I hated that God." Well, that takes a lot of courage. It didn't end there, but it was the willingness to know, the ferocity of it, that made it possible to know more. So we are in what I'd say is very volatile and scary terrain around feelings about what comes forward. And in a sense, we bear our own wounds and deficits, which we must honor and tend. And simultaneously, as one of my friends always says to her husband, before they leave the house on an outing, "Take a good look in the mirror, Jamie, and remember who is supposed to be the adult on this trip." She said it has helped us to keep some roles straight.
She said
we just wanted to do that for each other because she said our daughter is quite gifted.
It's necessary.
At getting us confused. So let me stop there for comment. I'm sorry, I ran a little longer than expected, but please, those of you who need to fetch children or get to lunch, please feel free to depart as you need to. And those of you who'd like to say a little more, please feel free to stay. But the session is officially ended.
Over.
11. Is it? Oh, I think it goes to 11:45, or is it now ending at 11:30?
I don't know. This is their first day.
I think it goes to 11:45.
I don't want to.
No. So please, don't worry about it. Yes, please. Is
the end? I was just going to say one of the things you said was struck me was that we as parents can give all that we can, or something on that order, and the value of the community around us. And the adults that are part of that community that we as parents need. And I think that, you know, I have found in big city of the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, my community of adults is not only my family, but also my church and some of those adult roles. And you see, and I happen to be in education, but you see so many kids that just do have their parents in this public school setting that I knew I had, and they're hurting for adult.
Yes. And here's another place where mirroring is so valuable, because you get. I remember my parents visited. We went to San Diego to the San Diego Zoo, and we got about 400 feet from the polar bear compound, and Lucy just. One of those tantrums where you just want to die. And Grandpa and Grandma stood there, and I finally said, "You can pretend you don't know us and go on." Okay. But I remember at some point later, I used this in a sermon illustration and about precisely how the intervention of, how everybody who had children our age looked away from us like it might be infectious. But that a lot of the elderly people, and it was so funny. After it was over, Lucy's Sunday school teacher, who was from South Carolina, came up to me and she said, "Pastor, I know you wouldn't laugh from the pulpit, but that couldn't have been my Lucy you were talking about." Now, what was helpful for me was to remember, Lucy's a lot of different people. She's not just my Lucy. Right? And in one of my favorite books, the one is called, if you remember, you read it, How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk. And then another book I've enjoyed called It's Not Fair, Jeremy Spencer Gets to Stay Up All Night, where the author of that book pointed out that for parents, the rule is what you see is not what you get. That very often what you see is not at all what your children are learning very well, is to negotiate the different spaces. And that they, the things that you see at home that make you think, oh my gosh, you know, it's San Quentin, here we come. Something is not what they do outside, because they know. But what they do is say, but I know this has to be dealt with. And they're making some judicious, responsible decisions about where it's going to come out. And so, right? And so that what you don't want to do then is say, oh, we don't say that in our household. You know, I mean, sort of, you need to, I mean, at some point, yes, there are, I don't want to say there are no limits, but do you see what I mean? That's where we got to work at it. That, and where it helps having other adults, where it really does. I mean, one of the, I mean, and I've seen that for Lucy. I mean, that, and it doesn't matter how many parents are in the family. My gosh, it's exhausting work. So, of course, it is good, and the churches can be so valuable in this. So, well, just these people over in Narnia. You know, do you find yourself just dying when you try? I mean, somebody said, oh, so you're going to Narnia. And they go, I hate it! And you just want to, like, die, you know? I mean, and they're like, unfazed. Unfazed. Well, okay, now, so what would you like to do? I mean, you know, sort of, where, and I think that that's really important to help you put it in perspective about, well, it's all right, but you're still going, right? I mean, but do you realize how, think of how many times in your own life if somebody had said, you don't have to like it, you don't have to express, you know, you just go, that it would have been quite liberating, because then you would have been able to keep clear what you really felt and what you were doing. It didn't mean that, you know, that it always had to be that you got your way, but you had a right to your feelings.
Mm-hmm. Validation.
And I think so often, if you look back, we find is we didn't always feel we had a right to our feelings. Mm-hmm. Still actually don't. Yeah. So, you had your hand earlier, so I kind of came by you. So.
Oh, that's okay. Well, I just have a trouble with putting some of this together. You know, if I had no anger in my family, so you get this anger stuff going, and I, as a person, am so uncomfortable with it. And we're a family of five, and you live in this community, and you've got this one sort of central room you live in, and that's okay for this person to wig the whole house out.
No,
I'm there too.
Yes.
I mean, I just, everything in me is just...
Yeah, let me back off a bit to say, now, here's a place where I am not a parenting expert, right? So there'll probably be other people you want to consult more about that. I think... The point is here is that's what's not all right. There is a difference between somebody coming to recognize a feeling and validating it and then saying, now, what are we going to do? How are we going to use it? And the fact is that precisely because the big part of our learning is in a community to have and honor those feelings, but not say, I mean, that's the other kind of narcissism, right? If I'm pissed, the whole world has to get riled up. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. But the other thing is to say, because this is so disruptive to the rest of us, you can't be angry. You can't, you know, go away until you... It may be that they need to go away for a while. But do you see, I mean, and I think that's the thing about finding a balance. And let me say, then we move into a realm of techniques. And these are good and valid things, and why I would recommend to you, whatever sort of program you might choose, something, find a group like that. One of the best things for me is this problem-solving group. This is the particular problem, precisely ones like this. And the negative effects, because when there are other people in the household, everybody has a right to recognition in space. Right? What are some techniques for how we might work that out? And there's another place, as a parent, in a way, you have to have endless sort of tricks in your bag, so to speak. But that's not meant as manipulation or trickery. It can, you can give true names to things and still make it work. Do you see what I mean? And I think what we're often afraid of is that once the anger is acknowledged, that there's somehow it's going to engulf us. So that and what you do is help a person learn not to. That won't work. That simply won't work. Okay, so I agree with you. This is not method acting, you know, where, I mean, I want to just, but those are sort of two different things going on. Do you see what I mean? In recognizing the child's need. And remember, one of the big things they're asking from us all the time is boundaries. That they really don't, how far can I go and it's okay, and when is it not okay? And that's one of the things you see, they don't know. They really don't know. So that's a big part of what you have to do. But on the other hand, you should not have to spend your life as a referee. You know, so that would be my way. And I found STEP helpful. But there are a lot of different things to go about it. But, you know, check, and here's my advice. Check with your local hospital. Check with your pediatrician. The United Way, Lutheran Social Services, they should be able to give you at least some, or the Y. I mean, another, I think often the YMCA will do things like that. Where those are available, and take advantage of them. Because remember, as Luther said, reason is not helpful in matters of salvation. But in the matters of living together and making our lives work, we have a lot of gifts, and we should draw off every piece of it. This is not going to be solved simply by prayer. and then also that gives you an entree into resource, because you may come up against something that's really trickier. And you have to be the one sometimes to be able to have the courage to name, my child's got a problem that goes beyond just sort of what can be solved here. And how can I help them get the resources that they need? And to be able to name it and not in shame. See, that's the place. What does that say about me? It says you're a wise and caring person who recognizes that the one in front of you is a unique individual and may need some things that you can't give. And that's okay.
On occasion, you may check if your local rental place has straitjackets.
Or even just sometimes, time with friends. I mean, I think sometimes two kids, especially when you have a big family circle, I suspect they vie more oftentimes to be front and center. You know that, and so they're just as when I've talked to people now, I only have one, so it's not. Although she's quite jealous of the cat. I'm serious. When I brought the cat home, she was her place. She was pleased, and I realized the first night she was there, she peed in his bed. I think I said, oh, as one of my friends said, isn't that funny? You get a cat and now you have a toddler who marks her territory. So the other way around, you know. So I want to say, this want to be clear, Mom, you could be nice to this cat, but yeah. Not at my expense. That then one of the important things oftentimes, you see a pattern like that, and you say, how can you give children individual time that they may need something different from a family activity, and that they don't communicate. You sometimes want to say, well, why didn't you just tell me that instead of doing this? But part of it is that they don't know, and how you can help and begin to say, you know, I've noticed this is happening. Are you, can you tell me more about what you're feeling? Or would this, and that then they begin to be able to know it and know when to apply some of the solutions, or that you know that. I think what is one of the hardest things for us is to remember what it's like to be a child. What they don't know, or how they'll internal. I mean, Lucy the other night asked somebody here at the village, she said, why do they shoot dogs? And she said, well, I don't know. And she said, well, when I was at Grandma's, we had hot dogs a lot. Now, I think that's a pretty reasonable question, yeah. But what a horror that there she's thinking, or, you know, why do they shoot dogs? Right? And but I'm just saying, so that's why sometimes don't hesitate to ask questions of them. because what comes out may really, the problem may be so different from what you think it is. Yeah, because they don't know. But it's a real imaginative exercise. And I think one of the other pieces that Alice Miller gives us is that for many of us, there are some real scars and pains around childhood, so that actually going back to our own and trying to engage theirs is not always easy. You know, I mean, it takes some courage, and you need to give yourself credit for it.